So can we have 1 minute of silence, please? Ladies and gentlemen, once again, Dr. Deepak Chopra.
Okay, so somebody said, is this theory of Maya referred and not referred to in, by Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita? If so, it is very well elucidated through science. Why did consciousness want to move at all? How to hold on to this consciousness practically? A still screen away from the off and on, from the blinking. How to face its presence? So first of all, of course, everything I've said is there in not only Bhagavad Gita, but in all the Upanishads. The most profound understanding of consciousness and its activity, to my knowledge, which may not be the most accurate, but to my knowledge is in the Yoga Vashisht, which is the teaching of consciousness to Ram. I don't know if you know the story, but Ram as a child is sent to Vashisht for teaching. And when Ram sees Vashisht, he touches the feet of Vashisht, and Vashisht says, stop doing that, you're God, you're not supposed to touch my feet. And Ram says, I've forgotten, can you help me remember? So, and then the whole Yoga Vashisht comes from there. It's the teaching of the Guru to the incarnation of God. It's a beautiful metaphor for all of us, that everyone has that divinity, but we have forgotten. So the key to that is to remember. And remembrance comes through, you can use many words to talk about it, but the words I like to, three words that I'm very fond of are satsang, seva, and simran. Satsang is what we're doing just now, having a conversation. To have a conversation where we all have the same intention. Seva is what you do here in this great institution of the Brahma Kumaris, doing seva throughout the world. And Simran is to remember, which the Sufis refer to that as zikr also. And there's a phrase that you don't have to struggle to learn, you simply have to remember. Whenever you struggle to learn, then your intellect gets in the way. But and you quieten your mind, then there's remembrance. So what I'd like to do in the next 45 minutes or a little more, 50 minutes, I want to share with you 15 insights. And then in the afternoon when I do my session, I'll talk about some very practical things as well. But let me share with you the 15 insights that I have found to be more important in my life as a way to remember. You know, the insights are just basic ideas that if you hold on to, then what happens is that the ideas themselves begin to start a process in consciousness, which is very fascinating. You know, consciousness mutates or transforms itself around ideas if you hold them to be true, if you believe in them. And I think belief should always be based on some rational sense of conviction. You know, if you believe totally blindly, that is that's a sign, sometimes, to me at least, a sign of insecurity. Now, I don't have to believe in gravity, I know it exists. I don't have to believe in electricity, I know it exists. So belief can sometimes be a cover-up for insecurity. True belief comes from understanding and experience. And one of the ways to get to the deep understanding and experience is to see if you hold on to an idea and see what it does to your consciousness. Because ideas, as they transform consciousness, you look at the same thing, you look at it very, very differently over a period of time. And then when you look back 10 years later, you say, oh my God, I used to think like that. I didn't realize. Now I think completely differently. So let me share with you 15 insights. And these are actually the basis of my new book, which is called The Book of Secrets, which I saw someone had it just now. And in 2 weeks from now, I have another book. Anji, Picho, yeah? Yeah, yeah. Well, I know that. But so what happens is 2 weeks from now, I have a new book coming out. It's called Peace is the Way. And before I finish today, I have an idea that I want to share with you, which I think especially this wonderful organization, Brahma Kumaris, could really accelerate that process of global peace. Because I think right now what is happening is that thanks to Mr. George Bush, America is accelerating its irrelevance in the world. And so we have to be very very grateful that he got re-elected, because he'll definitely facilitate the irrelevance of militarism, and hopefully we will be part of the new paradigm as it emerges. So I want to share with you that later. But these are the 15 insights, okay? The first insight is there is a hidden dimension. There is a hidden dimension, an invisible realm of infinite possibilities from which the whole universe emerges. And that hidden dimension, the access to that hidden dimension is through the soul. Through the soul. Now, what I would like to do, if you have a piece of paper, I'm going to ask you 7 questions. And to each question, just write down 3 words, okay? Only 3 words. Are you ready? Okay, if you're ready. So I'm going to ask the question. You don't have to write the question, just write the answer. Okay? And the answer should be no more than 3 words. Okay? So in 3 words, write down 3 words that describe a peak experience that you may have had. You know what a peak experience is? When you were extremely joyous. Maybe you felt love in a very profound way, or you felt the presence of God, or you saw something beautiful, or you were touched by something sacred. So three words to describe a peak experience. That's the first question. In three words, describe a peak experience that you may have had. Everybody has different peak experience. Sometimes children have peak experience when they're playing, or when you hear beautiful music, or when you fall in love, or you feel the presence of God, or you do something extraordinary. Okay, so that's the first question. The second question is, in three words, write down your purpose in life. What's your purpose? Just in three words. Question number three. In three words, write down what you want your contribution to be to the world or to society. Just three words. Next question, in three or four words or five words, write down the names of your heroes, either in religion or in mythology or in history. Anybody from Krishna to Mahatma Gandhi, who are your heroes? Write down, or heroines. Write down four or five names. Next question, in three words, write down the qualities you most admire and look for in your friends. Next, write down in three words your unique talents, because the law of dharma says that everyone has at least three unique talents. That could be anything, from cooking to singing to neurosurgery. Write down three unique talents, and when you express your unique talents, you feel happy. And next question, write down in three words the qualities you best express in your personal relationships. The best qualities you express in your relationships. Okay, so the first question was peak experiences. Second question was purpose in life. Third question was contribution. Fourth question was heroes and heroines. Next question was the qualities you look for in others. Next question was your unique talents. And last question was the qualities you best express in your relationship. So if you wrote three words at least for every question, then you have 21 words. Those 21 words describe your soul profile. That's your profile of your soul. If I had to do your ego profile, then I would ask you, how much money do you make? Or what's your position in your company? What kind of house do you live in? What kind of car do you drive? Who are your influential friends? Your cronies, your buddies. Influence peddling, cronyism, money, possessions, status, that would be ego profile. But we're not talking about that, we're talking about soul profile. Because the soul is in the space between thoughts, right? So what is the space? We already know. The space is pure potentiality, the space is co-creation with God, the space is quantum creativity, the space is comfortable with uncertainty, the space is omniscient. And my soul is between my thoughts, your soul is between your thoughts. And it's the window, the corridor to the hidden dimensions of the universe. But your soul is different than my soul for one reason. And that reason is karma. We have had different experiences in the past. And from those different experiences, we have created context, meaning, relationship, and archetypal relationships with gods, with goddesses, with heroes, with mythological figures, etc. So, each soul is slightly different. It's the same Atman, but the Jiva is different. Okay, the Jiva is a little, texture is different. And that texture of the Jiva comes from experience, past experience, which is karma. Karma, which is in our tradition, it's called sanskara. From sanskara comes vasana. Vasana is the thread of intention or desire. And from vasana comes karma again. So, karma, vasana, sanskara is the software of the soul. Okay, it's the software that creates all the experience of life. Every thought that we have, every thought. When you meditate, very frequently people complain, I have too many thoughts. What are these thoughts? These are karma. They are threads of memory and wisps of desire from past experience. So this of course everyone knows in our culture. It's a beautiful story of one day Buddha was standing on the streets of Banaras and Ananda said to him, can you tell me about life? And at that moment a chariot passed and Buddha pointed to the wheel of the chariot and he said, life is like that wheel. The wheel is called samsara, the journey of existence. And that's a samsara comes from karma, sanskara, vasana and karma all over again. It's the wheel. So now that wheel has texture that creates meanings, context, relationships, and archetypal relationships. Archetypal relationships means the relationships with the symbolic expression of the absolute. Because the absolute is beyond imagination. Can't conceptualize the absolute. If you try to conceptualize the absolute, then you limit the absolute. The moment you conceptualize anything, even God, you have limited God. Right? You have limited God to your concept. God is not a concept. God is reality. And reality cannot be conceptualized. Only Maya can be conceptualized. So even our highest expression of God, Krishna, Ram, whatever, is still a concept. Okay? It's still a concept. It's not the highest level. No matter what you say, the highest level of concept of God, even at the level of Krishna and Ram, is still not the highest level. Because in the moment you conceptualize, you have taken the absolute and you've given a definition. And now, once you've given a definition, you have limited the absolute. The absolute cannot be limited. So what to do? In order to develop a relationship with the absolute, you conceptualize the highest possible level that your mind is capable of. And that highest possible level your mind is capable of is Krishna, is Ram, is all these wonderful avatars. And then you develop a relationship with them. That becomes the archetypal theme of your soul. Your soul needs that connection. And so from that comes meaning, from that comes context, and it's woven around karma, memory, and desire. So these 21 attributes that I've asked you to name, if you look at those attributes, they are the meanings, then the context, and the relationships, and the archetypal structures of your soul. And if you just do one thing and nothing else, when you make a choice, you say, is my choice consistent with who I am? And if the answer is yes, then that choice will lead to success. If the answer is no, the choice will not lead to success. That's the basic, fundamental principle of success. Success that is true success comes from the soul. Success that is temporary, or power that is temporary, comes from the ego. From the ego you get agency power. The agency. The ego is your agency. Money, power, connections, influence, etc. As long as that agency is there, the power is there. As long as the agency is gone, the power is gone. True power comes from the level of the soul. So, that power cannot be taken away from you because it's yours. And that power comes from the meanings, the context, the relationships, the archetypal themes of your life. There is nothing more, for me, your soul profile is more important than your passport. You should keep it in your pocket all the time and look at it and say, kya baat? You know, this is who I am. And this is how I will structure my life based on this. Is this choice consistent with who I am? Okay, so that's the first principle. There's a hidden dimension. That hidden dimension has personal domain, which is Jivatma, which is what we define. It has a collective domain, which is all the archetypal symbols, the gods and the goddesses of our mythology. The word mythology in English is the same word as Maya. Okay? Mythology, Maya, Mata, Matrika, Mother, Matter, Matrix, Meter, Music, all the same word. Because we cannot conceptualize the absolute, we have to measure. So Maya also means measure. Matrika, measurement. Okay, so Maya, strictly speaking, is not illusion. Maya, strictly speaking, the exact etymology of the word Maya is measurement. We cannot measure the infinite, so we symbolically express it as Maya. Okay. From there comes all of creation. Mythology, therefore, is very important. India has such a rich mythology because mythology is the way we develop a relationship with the Absolute. Joseph Campbell, who was a modern day mythologist, he said mythology is truer than history. Why? Because history is only journalism, and we know how reliable journalists are. But mythology, it is the connection of the soul to the Absolute. Okay? Mythology captures the collective desire, the collective yearning, the collective imagination, the collective symbology of our connection to the Absolute. So there's a personal domain, Jivatma, the collective domain through mythology, the relationship that we have with God through mythology, and then there's the absolute domain which cannot be conceptualized, which can only be experienced in deep and profound silence. Second insight. We do not exist in the world exists in us. I already tried to hint at that there is, you know, what we see as the external world out there is actually a radically ambiguous and ceaselessly flowing quantum soup. The world is conceived in consciousness. So you don't exist out there, you exist in my consciousness. And I don't exist here, I exist in your consciousness. And the place where I exist in your consciousness and you exist in my consciousness is the same place. And furthermore, it's not a place. Where you exist in me and where I exist in you is the same place and it's not a place. Because as soon as you say place, you localize it in space and time. And space-time is all Maya. It doesn't really, it's all perceptual artifact. Where we exist in each other, we are all contained in each other. We can only experience when we experience love. Rabindranath Tagore used to say, love is not a sentiment, love is not an emotion. Love is the ultimate truth at the heart of creation. So when we experience love, profound love, then we experience that you exist in me and I exist in you. It's impossible for me to hurt or be hurt. Just holding on to this principle that the world exists in me and I don't exist in the world. So when I look at a flower, I say, that flower is not there, it's in me. And that's a statement of accuracy. Okay. When I look at a tree, I say, that tree is not out there, it's in me. Actually, it's my lungs. If that tree didn't breathe, I wouldn't breathe. If I didn't breathe, that tree wouldn't breathe. It's technically true. The earth is my mother. The rivers and waters are my circulation. The air is my breath. And it all exists in me. So just that little shift, I'm not in the world is in me, as Lord Krishna says, Prakritim Swam Vashtabhai Vishwajami Puna Puna. I start to slowly, just holding on to the idea, as I see people and things in the universe in me, I start to feel that love, and I know then that I'm connecting. Second insight. Third insight, there are four ways of exploring the hidden dimension. Four ways. Everyone knows all this. I don't know why I'm telling you all this, but it's fun. Four ways of exploring the hidden dimension. Rajyog, Bhakti Yog, Gyan Yog, and Karma Yog. Now I know you've heard this millions of times, but I have to say, I tell you my interpretation of this, because I sometimes think it's made too complicated by people. Okay. Raj Yoga is any yoga that gives you the experience of silence, whatever that is. Of course, it's meditation more profound than anything. The stillness in consciousness that comes from meditation is Raj Yoga. So, you have your own, I have my own, perhaps we share, perhaps you do jap, you do mantra, perhaps you do breathing, perhaps you do other forms of yoga, doesn't matter. As long as you can find that stillness inside you, then the state of being that we call stillness is Raj Yoga. Bhakti Yoga, of course, the common interpretation is worship, which is fine, and I think it's very wonderful. But what is worship but a feeling? Now, there's being, there's feeling. So, to me, Bhakti Yoga is when you feel deeply, when you feel compassion, when you feel love. And even if it's not for God, but for another person, that in a form is Bhakti Yoga. The deep feeling of love and compassion and understanding and forgiveness is Bhakti Yoga. Gyan Yoga. Gyan Yoga is the razor's edge, as the Upanishads say. He said, be careful, because the more you know, the more arrogant you'll become, and that will take you away. If you get attached to, more you know, the more you realize, the more I know, the more I don't know. There's the known, there's the unknown, then there's, first there's the known, then there's the unknown, then there's the unknown that I don't know is the unknown, and then there's the unknowable. So as long as I understand that science can take me to a certain level, but even science tells me that when I get into the discontinuity, then what I find? Uncertainty. Okay, uncertainty is built into the discontinuity. So God says, I will let you come up to this point, but after this, you have to surrender. I'm not giving you the whole story. Okay, so Einstein, when quantum physics was first first discovered Einstein made the statement, he said, I don't think God would play dice with the universe. And Stephen Hawking recently said, God not only plays dice with the universe, God throws the dice where you can't find it. Okay? Uncertainty is not a principle of our inability to find it. Uncertainty is built into the laws of nature. The laws of nature preclude you from knowing everything. So no matter how far science goes, it will never take you to the ultimate. So that's the limitation of Gyan Yoga. Every other yoga, Bhakti Yoga, Raj Yoga will take you to the absolute, but Gyan Yoga will not take you to the absolute. It will take you to the edge of the absolute. And finally, Karma Yoga. Karma Yoga, again, you know, we many interpretations, be detached from the result, do what has to be done, but don't pay attention to the fruit, etc., etc. For me, it's a very simple thing, Karma Yoga. Karma Yoga is an inner attitude which says that everything I do comes from God and belongs to God. It's not even my business. Okay, so every movement of mine, every breath of mine, every action of mine, it's a divine movement of the eternal. It comes from God and belongs to God. So if I'm going to write a book, no. God is going to write the book, I'll collect the royalties. Okay? That's all. Okay. And thank God for that. So if, as long as you can give all credit, not externally, but internally. You can take the credit externally. I take it, I sign the books and everything. But as long as I don't take the credit internally, then I'm a Karma Yogi. So actually there are four attitudes. Actually you can think of these four yogas as four attitudes. The attitude to being, the attitude to feeling, the attitude to thinking, and the attitude to action. And that's who we are as human beings. We are either being, either or feeling, or thinking, or doing. And so those are the four steps to finding the hidden dimension of existence. That's the third insight. The fourth insight is there is no fulfillment that is external. All fulfillment comes from inside. The West has, in many ways, given us a very false promise. The false promise is that money will make us happy, number one. The second false promise is that if you have military, you will be secure. The third false promise is that if you have technology, all problems will be solved. Well, recently I saw a survey of happiness. The most miserable people live in Russia, and after that, in the United States. People in Nigeria, Venezuela, the poorest countries in the world, Cuba, are happier. So money or some happiness is not around the corner. It's a totally false premise. Who has the biggest military in the world? The United States. Who are the most insecure people in the world? The United States. In fact, the more military power you have, the more insecure you become. It's a total false premise that weapons and armies and militarism give security. And finally, the fact that technology will make us solve all our problems. It actually aggravates the problems. You use technology is neutral. How we use technology depends on our consciousness. So technology is very powerful if you use it. You know, I personally think that the internet is the most powerful technology that we have today for good. The internet is the physical manifestation of the Akashic record. Everything that's happening in human consciousness is now represented in the internet. Both the divine and the diabolical. Both the sacred and the profane. It's represented, both the sinner and the saint. But that is the record of human consciousness. The internet is the collective cloning of our soul. So we can use it for good, if we want to. And I will share with you how I think we can. So that's the fourth insight. All fulfillment comes from within. There's no fulfillment from outside. And that comes from within as a creative process. You know, one of the best ways to define spirituality, it's creativity. Okay, spirituality is not self-righteous morality. You know, the more self-righteous people are in their morality, the more later on we find they're hypocrites. You know, it's a mask. The self-righteous morality, I'm right and you're wrong, is a mask for hypocrisy. H.G. Wells said, self-righteous morality is just jealousy with a halo. So true spirituality is that creativity. Who's God? The ultimate creator. Therefore, if I have a connection to God, I must have creativity to solve the problems of humanity and my problems by getting in touch with that creator. Spirituality is creativity directed inwards. Creativity directed outwards is science and technology. Creativity directed inwards is spirituality. Insight number 5. Suffering is a fact of existence. We cannot deny that suffering does not exist. Vedanta says that there are 5 reasons that we suffer, human beings suffer, called the 5 kleshas. The first klesha is not knowing who you are. Dadiji hinted at that. Main kaun hu? Bhagwan kaun hai? Okay, so the first klesha is not knowing who we are. The second klesha is grasping and clinging at the impermanent. The third klesha is recoiling and being afraid of the impermanent. The fourth klesha is identifying with a socially induced hallucination called the ego. Because ego has no reality. Ego is just a socially induced hallucination that we help create with each other. And the fifth klesha is the fear of death. Because as human beings, we are aware that one day we are all going to die. Look behind you and the prince of death is stalking you. And since I last looked, a little closer. You know, we're all one day closer to death. And actually, death is the fear of the unknown. And Rabindranath Tagore said, the only way you'll conquer the fear of death is if you make the unknown your friend. You make the unknown known to you. The 5 kleshas, Vedanta says, are all contained in the first klesha, not knowing the true nature of reality. If you understand the true nature of reality, then all the other 4, grasping, clinging, recoiling, being afraid of, identifying with the ego, and the fear of death, they disappear. So that's the 5th insight. Now, you know, I'm just giving you the insights to hold on to as the sutras for finding the hidden dimension. The 6th insight is there is power in choiceless awareness and self-referred consciousness. There is power in choiceless awareness and self-referred consciousness. Choiceless awareness is when your awareness is on the self. Like when I asked you a little while earlier, listening to me, just become aware of who's listening. That moment was a moment of choiceless awareness. And when we have choiceless awareness, then we are independent of the good and bad opinion of others. We are in touch with our feelings. We are not easily offended. We are not obsessed with power or control or money. We are detached from trivial and mundane things. And we move with spontaneity. There's no too much planning. You just move with the flow of the universe, because everything happens when it's supposed to happen. Your intelligence is more contextual. There is Shakti in every moment of existence, and that's real power. Ichha Shakti, Kriya Shakti, Gyan Shakti, Chit Shakti, all the feminine forces of the universe are with you when you are in choiceless awareness. The 6th insight. The 7th insight is the one way to measure your spiritual progress is by looking at the world as a mirror. Because in every moment, what is happening to you externally is a reflection of what's happening inside. Every moment, every relationship, every situation, every circumstance, every event that you see is happening externally. Doesn't matter how bad or good it is, it's a reflection of what's happening in the inner dimension. So you want to change something outside there, you go inside and say, what's the shift I require? That's the seventh insight. I monitor my spiritual progress by looking at the world as a mirror to myself. If things go wrong, I don't look for solutions outside. I see what needs to be changed inside. Nothing is random. Nothing is accidental. Everything happens for a reason. Eighth insight. What we call evil in the world is a projection of our collective shadow. So the human soul is not 100% good. The human soul has the seeds of both divine and diabolical. The human soul has both the sinner and the saint. The human soul has both the sacred and the profane. The human soul has unconditional love, but it also has forbidden lust. In a way, that makes it very interesting, because if there was only one aspect to the human soul, there would be nothing to do. We'd all be doomed to eternal senility, and everything would be very boring. So it is the ambiguity of the human soul that gives contrast. You know, there's light and there's darkness, there's sinner and there's saint. You know, Nisargadatta Maharaj used to say that the only difference between a sinner and a saint is that the saint has a past and the sinner has a future. So don't judge. Okay? The sinner and the saint are merely exchanging notes. Let it be. And in that, see how evil is created as a projection of our collective shadow. What's the collective shadow? The shadow in me is that part of me which I do not honestly want to face, which I deny, which I say does not exist. And the more I deny, the stronger it gets, because anything you deny, it gets stronger. And then at some point, it manifests as pathology. The shadow is primitive, the shadow is irrational, the shadow is dangerous, the shadow is dark, the shadow is secretive. The shadow is shrouded in myth, Ravan. Ravan is the shadow of the divine energy. Okay, for every Deva, there's a Raksha. You wouldn't have the play of the universe if the Asuras weren't there. So we all have that shadow. And that shadow will emerge when there is lack of responsibility, when there is anonymity, when there is poor leadership, when there are poor examples of peer behavior, where there is bystanders who passively ignore what is happening, when there is us versus them mentality, when there is isolation, when there is lack of love, when there are degrading conditions, then the shadow comes. I think in the news you read what the American soldiers did to the prisoners in Abu Ghraib prison. Are you familiar with that? Okay, so now, you know, when the stories came out, the official response was, that's not American people. American people are not like that. Only these jihadis are like that. We are very good. Beware of people who say we are very good. Okay, they are not facing their shadow. What happens is, you create the right conditions, everybody will be like that. People are not inherently evil, but the shadow will emerge if you can create the conditions, the degrading conditions for the shadow to emerge. How do I deal with evil? By first acknowledging that I have a shadow as well. And if I can embrace my own shadow and give it the light of awareness and love and compassion and forgiveness and understanding, then I diminish the evil in the world. So that's the eighth insight. The ninth insight is, we live in multi-dimensions. We have not woken up to our multi-dimensionality. most people will go through life in three states of consciousness: waking, dreaming, sleeping. And the whole lifetime will go by and we're not even experiencing the other states of consciousness that create other realities. All these multidimensional universes that we hear about in Vedanta and even Theosophy, they are different projections of consciousness. So, beyond waking, dreaming and sleeping is the fourth state of consciousness. The fourth stage of consciousness in our tradition is called Turiya. Turiya is when your consciousness shifts from waking, dreaming and sleeping to a glimpse of your soul, even a momentary glimpse of your soul. And you realize there's more to reality than meets the eye. The beautiful poem by Walt Whitman, when he first experienced his soul, he said, "I must not be awake, for everything looks to me as it never did before. Or else I'm awake for the first time, and all that was before was just asleep." So the fourth state of consciousness is Turiya, when you wake up to the hidden dimension. But then beyond Turiya is Turiya Tatta, which means that this ever-present witnessing awareness, which in our language we call Sakshi, the silent witness. When the silent witness is fully awake in waking, dreaming and sleeping, that's called Turiya Tatta. In English, the best translation for that is cosmic consciousness. Cosmic consciousness means my body is fast asleep, but I, the witness, is observing the body in sleep state. Or my body is dreaming and I, the witness, is observing the body in the dream state. Or my body is giving this lecture, but I, the spirit, is observing the body giving this lecture. So in cosmic consciousness, you have both local and non-local awareness simultaneously. Local awareness is when your awareness or consciousness is localized to objects in space and time. And non-local awareness is when your awareness is with the absolute, with the ever-present witnessing awareness. So it's called cosmic consciousness, and it's referred to even in the New Testament when Jesus Christ says, "I'm in this world but not of it." So in cosmic consciousness, you have an alert witnessing of the roles you play. At the same time, you know that you're not the roles you're playing. Like right now, I'm playing the role of this Deepak Chopra who's giving the lecture. But when I talk to my son, I don't play the role of Deepak Chopra giving a lecture. I play the role of a father. When I talk to my mother, I don't play the role that I play with Gautam. I play the role of a son. When I think of a patient, I don't play those roles. I play the role of a doctor. It's our destiny to play an infinity of roles, but we are not the roles we are playing. And so in cosmic consciousness, you become aware of the roles you play and you don't identify with any role you play. Not even in dream, not even in sleep, not even in waking consciousness. And when you start having cosmic consciousness, then you start to actually have a connection to what is happening in the non-local world. This is the realm where coincidences start to occur, where miracles start to happen, where creativity blossoms, where solutions appear spontaneously because you're connected. That's the fifth state of consciousness. The sixth state of consciousness is called God consciousness, beyond cosmic consciousness. Each state of consciousness creates a different functioning of the nervous system because these are physiological states, and because the nervous system is responsible for perception and cognition and feelings and emotions and biology and social interactions and environment and the behavior of nature, with each shift in consciousness, all of this shifts. Everything shifts. Perception shifts, cognition shifts, emotions shift, biology shifts, social interaction shift, environment shifts, nature shifts. Because nature is not independent of our consciousness. So, in God consciousness, there's the blossoming of what our rishis call the siddhis and the riddhis. Siddhis are supernormal powers in the natural world, and riddhis is control over the elements and forces of the cosmos. In God consciousness, what happens is, I become aware, I can't get this. I become aware of the ever-present witnessing awareness in the object of my perception. So local perception is, this is a beautiful flower. Has a nice smell. Soft. My non-local perception, as I look at this flower, I see rainbows and sunshine and earth and water and wind and air and the whole universe manifesting as this flower. I see the infinite void. I see the creation of the universe. And then, as I go beyond that, I feel the presence of God. If I can't find God in this, I won't find God in a book of religion. Because God is not a concept. God is the holy presence of the Spirit in every object of our perception. And in God consciousness, you communicate. The Spirit here communicates with the Spirit here. And because the Spirit here communicates with the Spirit here, it's also the realm of miracles. Because Spirit is communing with Spirit. So in God consciousness, Spirit or God is not difficult to find. God is impossible to avoid. Wherever you go, in every object, you feel the presence of God. That's the sixth state of consciousness. The seventh state of consciousness is unity consciousness or Brahman consciousness, where the ever-present witnessing awareness in the subject of experience, the ever-present witnessing awareness in the subject of experience becomes one with the ever-present witnessing awareness in the object of experience, and there is both the intellectual and the experiential realization that there's only one witness. And the whole universe is a manifestation of that one witness. And I am that witness. So, when my spirit not only communes with your spirit, but merges with your spirit, and then I feel that there's only one spirit, the whole universe is my manifestation. Chapter 10 of Bhagavad Gita. When Arjun says to Krishna, reveal to me who you are. And then he sees the whole universe in Krishna's being, unity or Brahman consciousness. So there's an evolution. This is what we talk about. Evolution is an ongoing process, and everyone is on the journey whether they know it or not. But by putting a little attention, the journey accelerates. And in that is the experience of the multidimensional nature of the universe, because the universe is different in different states of consciousness. Biology is different in different states of consciousness. Knowledge is different in different states of consciousness. Perception is different in different states of consciousness. That's the ninth insight. The tenth insight. Death makes life possible. Death makes life possible. In biology, there's a phenomenon. In cellular biology, there's a phenomenon we call apoptosis. Apoptosis means cellular death, programmed cellular death. My stomach cells have to die every 5 days so they can incarnate again as new cells. My skin cells have to die every month so my skin can remain healthy. My liver cells have to die every 6 weeks so I can have a healthy liver. When our body takes a vacation from death, we call it cancer. Because what are cancer cells? But cells that have forgotten how to die. Death is built into the universe as the mechanism for birth. As the mechanism for resurrection. When cells forget how to die, they become cancerous. So, at every level, photons are born and die, atoms are born and die, molecules are born and die, organisms are born and die, and ultimately our souls express and re-express through the mechanism of death. If there was no death, we would be doomed to senility, the universe would have no rhythm, and everything would be static and mummified. A two-year-old has to die so that the three-year-old can emerge. A three-year-old has to die so the teenager can emerge. The teenager has to die, the adult can emerge, and the old person has to die so that the universe can be born again to look at itself with fresh eyes. Every soul wants to evolve and look at itself through fresh eyes. Therefore, death should be seen as the great resurrection. Death should be seen as the great friend that we have that prevents us from becoming mummified and doomed to senility. Death should be welcomed in every moment by letting go of the past. Because the past is not here. It's only in imagination. The future is not here. It's only in imagination. Birth and death, the junction point between birth and death is life. Where the unknown becomes the known. The junction point between the unknown and the known is death. And when death is not seen as an enemy, then life becomes full of joy and of priorities. Tagore says in one of his poems, "I was not aware when I first came into this world. What was that great mystery that I woke up to? And tomorrow when the curtain will come down again, I shall enter the same unknown which was ever known to me." So that's the 10th insight. The 11th insight is, the universe thinks through me. If you have that attitude, that's also karma yoga, at least to karma. The universe thinks through me. If every thought comes from the universe, and I allow it to come through without the filter of my ego, then that thought is very powerful. So just having the inner attitude that when I am seeing, actually God is seeing God through these eyes. When I see when I look at a tree, God is looking at the tree through these eyes. When I look at you, God is looking at God through these eyes. If I have that inner attitude and I become convinced that I'm an instrument through which the universe perceives itself in infinity of ways. You know those paintings, those Tanka paintings you've seen where God has eyes everywhere. On his nails, on his hair follicles, on his nose, on his genitalia, everywhere. God is looking through all these sentient beings. God is looking at himself in an infinity of ways. Even the worst sinner is God looking at himself through those eyes. So the inner attitude, again, that the universe thinks through me. 12th insight. The only time is now. The only time is now. Now is the moment that never ends. Now is the moment of power. Now is the connection to God. The past is gone. The future is not here. This moment is real. And therefore the only step that I'm taking that is real is the step I'm taking this moment. God is available to me this moment. Not tomorrow, not yesterday, but this moment. If I cannot feel the presence of God this moment, then I won't find God. God is life-centered, present moment awareness, where I can step into the freshness of the unknown in every moment of my life. 13th insight. I will be truly free when I realize that I'm not a person. Because if I think of myself as a person, then I'll see people everywhere. But when I realize that I'm actually the infinite being pretending to be a person, then I'll see God everywhere. So what's that phrase, Thiyad Dachardin and many other people say, we are not human beings that have an occasional spiritual experience. We are spiritual beings that have an occasional human experience. 14th insight. There is mystery and connection in every coincidence. Now this afternoon I will talk about coincidences. Coincidence is the meaning through which we glimpse the universal domain. Because God's mind thinks through coincidences, coincidentally, synchronicity. So never ignore a coincidence. Coincidence is a window to divinity. And the 15th insight is, I will not stop asking questions till I find out who I am. We don't know the answers all the time, but as long as we keep asking questions, that will keep us on the journey. So I wanted to share those 15 insights as little ideas to keep in your mind for helping the process of transformation. This afternoon when we meet, we'll go a little deeper into the domain of synchronicity. Thank you very much. Why do we fear death so much? Now, how can we get over it? Well, the way to get over death is to find the nature of reality, to have the experience of your soul all the time. If you have the experience of your soul all the time, you will be convinced that it's the only part of you that doesn't die. So the only way to conquer the fear of death is to be in touch with that which never dies. Because as long as you're in touch with that which dies, you will be afraid of death. But if you're in touch and intimate, on a very intimate level, with what never dies, then you will never have the fear of death. So the only way to overcome the fear of death is to be in touch with that part of yourself that never dies. That's the soul. There's no other way. Also, the other thing is, everything dies, okay? This morning has died already. So when you hold on to the past, you will be afraid of death. If you let go of the past and you welcome what is happening now and what is coming, then you will lose the fear of death. The drive to function is taken away when we work without the me and mine. How then can we reconcile to optimal performance? No, the drive to function is never taken away when we lose me and mine, because you expand your sense of me and mine. Me is not the skin encapsulated ego. Me is the whole universe. So don't constrict yourself in your sense of me and mine. Me is we. Me is us. Me is my connection with God. So when you constrict yourself, then you can be successful with driving ambition, hard work, exacting plans, high blood pressure, and heart attacks. Okay? So if you're in touch with the bigger me and mine, then you can accomplish much more without paying the price in bad health. How do I know what I want so as to be able to create it? How do I know what I want? Close your eyes, put your attention on your heart, go into silence and ask yourself, what do I want? And then wait to hear the answer.
I've got two questions for you. First question is a very general question. Do you believe in God really, and what is your concept of God? You keep mentioning God. God did this, God did that. But
I don't
really believe
in
that.
Belief. I believe that belief is a cover-up for insecurity. I believe in faith, which is different from belief. Faith is knowing something with total certainty. So I have faith in God. Yes.
Uh-huh.
Okay. And you said, what's your concept of God?
Perception.
It's wrong question. Because as soon as you say, what's your concept of God, then you have limited God, okay, to your concept. So that's the wrong question. But having said that, God is the immeasurable potential for all that exists, and all that has ever existed, all that will ever exist. God is the source of information, energy, space, time, and matter. God is ad infinite to anything. Infinite love, infinite compassion, infinite knowledge, infinite wisdom. That's God.
One more question.
Any other thing? God,
last quick question.
Wait. One second. G-O-D, right?
Yeah.
Generator, organizer, and destroyer.
Yeah. One quick question. In the morning session, you were talking about consciousness and discontinuity, and you were going to take it on in the second session now, but probably that link has not been established.
I thought it was.
But can you do that in the next session then?
No, I did it.
Okay.
Compare and contrast soul and mind. Soul is the potential for mind. Mind is just information. Mind is knowledge, like the knowledge you get in reading the Encyclopedia Britannica or the knowledge in your computer. Soul is not that. Soul is self-referred consciousness that organizes the activity of the mind, organizes the activity of the body, and does so through non-local correlation. Non-local correlation means simultaneity. Your body functions both locally and non-locally. But I said simultaneity. You know, how does a human body think thoughts, play a piano, kill germs, remove toxins, and make a baby all at the same time? And whilst it's doing that, it's tracking the movement of stars and planets, because your biological rhythms are the rhythms of the cosmos. So that's what soul does. Mind just thinks thoughts, and usually useless thoughts.
Did God create human beings, or human beings created God to do good things?
Did God create human beings, or did human beings create God? Well, this is what in physics is called a tangled hierarchy. They are differentiated aspects. Now again, depends how you mean God, okay? The absolute consciousness, it differentiates into both creator and created. Okay? So Brahman differentiates into Paramatman and Atman. Okay? They're both aspects of the unmanifest. So the answer is, we co-create each other. Or we interdependently co-arise. You know, in Buddha's words, we are inter-beings that inter-arise in the inter-isness.
Dr. Chopra ji, how much do you believe in spiritual healing? I am Subhash Lakhotia from New Delhi. Spiritual healing, personal view, percentage only. And second question, quick question is, I feel I have the atoms of Swami Vivekananda. He is dead and gone. What I feel, can it happen? Yes or no?
Okay. So do I believe in spiritual healing? The only healing is spiritual.
Very good. Very nice.
Otherwise, there is no healing. Okay. You have the atoms of Swami Vivekananda? Yes. But you also have the atoms of everybody else.
Also. Huh?
So you have to focus on those atoms of Swami Vivekananda.
And out of the four yogas, which one personally you believe more? I feel from your speech it's the karma yoga. Yes or no?
I think for me bhakti yoga is actually more important.
Thank you very much.
If we determine who we are, then we limit the divinity in ourselves. Don't we? So, why limit ourselves? If you determine who you are, and then you actualize the potential of who you are, then who you are changes. You never limit. It's, you know, who you are is like a horizon. When you get to the horizon, there's another horizon. So, horizons are never ending. Is there life after death? Well, of course, just like there's death after life, the two make each other possible. Can we remember the past life? Who asked this question? You asked the question? Do you remember what you had for lunch 3 weeks ago on Wednesday? Do you? You do. What did you have? Nahi, parso kya khaya tha? Aur do hafte pehle kya khaya tha? Achha, kiske saath khaya tha? Kya khaya tha? You see, if he can't remember what he had for lunch 2 weeks ago, how is he going to remember past lifetime? Yes, the answer is actually, the answer is yes. But we only remember the things that are important. Agar do hafte pehle aap Pradhan Mantri ke saath lunch khaya, to bilkul sab yaad rahega kya khaya tha. Okay, so the things that we pay attention to, we remember. And it's good, because otherwise your mind would be loaded with unnecessary things. The things in your past life that are significant to you now, you can remember through what is called past life regression. There's a very simple technique of taking people through hypnosis to childhood, then into the womb, and then beyond. I teach it. नहीं, दो मिनट में सब नहीं होता. कॉस्मिक कॉन्शियसनेस एंड हिप्नोगॉगिक एक्सपीरियंस लोअर अल्फा लेवल टीएम स्टेट्स. आई थिंक इट्स अ मिस्टेक टू गिव टू मच कोरिलेशन बिटवीन दीज थिंग्स. टू सम एक्सटेंट यू कैन डू इट, बट कॉस्मिक कॉन्शियसनेस इज अ स्पिरिचुअल स्टेट ऑफ subjectivity, and that state of subjectivity may or may not be captured by alpha waves or delta waves and all that. I personally feel that the moment you start to drawing objective correlates of something that profound, you don't really get the true experience of it. Yes.
The number of questions for this session, I think we will ask Dr. Deepak Chopra to cancel his train in the evening and stay on for another week. We would love to have you here, sir, but probably you have other engagements.